Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and I'm here today with Spiked's deputy editor and host of the Last Orders podcast, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spiked columnist, Ella Whelan.
Hi.
Today on the show, we'll be discussing the protests against Anna Soubry, the viral stardom of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Bryan Cranston's latest role as a disabled billionaire.
Right. Well, apologies to if you're offended by what you're listening to.
I just think this is astonishing. This is what has happened to our country.
Come on, Soubry. Why do you think you're better than 17.4 million? Come on.
You're angry, aren't they? A tampon. I'm a tampon.
Look at these lovely people. Look at these lovely people.
This week, outside Parliament, protesters targeted the Tory MP and arch-remainer Anna Soubry, calling her a Nazi. The response was extraordinary. MPs called on the police to ramp up security around Parliament, and many in the media called for the protesters to be locked up. Tom, have they lost their minds?
I think they have lost their minds. Now, I don't want to appear callous to people who felt intimidated by some of those protesters, but if you look at the videos of the protesters surrounding Anna Soubry or the ones surrounding Owen Jones, what they're effectively doing is shouting at them, heckling them, calling them Nazis and traitors, pretty infantile stuff, but you know, it's a free country, and filming them and trying to ask them questions. I didn't see a single person lay a hand on anyone. I didn't see anyone block anyone's way, although apparently some of these protesters have been doing that elsewhere. I didn't even see anyone get egged. And yet the way in which this was being discussed, you would have thought that they had been, you know, jumped outside of Parliament and beaten to within an inch of their life. And I think it's actually a pretty terrifying precedent when you've got MPs, people like Anna Soubry, effectively calling on the police, as she did this week, alongside 50 MPs who wrote to the head of the Metropolitan Police, to effectively criminalise people shouting insults at them. And I think that sets a very dangerous precedent. And I think it's very dangerous when you're talking about the area around Parliament, which throughout history has been a free space, you know, in Parliament Square and on College Green, in which many people have protested against the establishment over the years. The point at which you're talking about ramping up security around there, just because at the end of the day, a few public figures were called names, I think that's a pretty terrible precedent to set, really.
And as you've said, there's been there's a lot of protests around that area. Politicians get protested at all the time. But Ella, is there a kind of double standard here? Why is this protest taken more seriously than other protests?
Yeah, it's definitely a case of people having a very short-term memory, because there have been some very serious protests against MPs in the past. If you just take the case of Nigel Farage, who for a very long time has, I don't want to use the word suffered, but certainly experienced quite high levels of protest and actual abuse, physical abuse. He has been egged. He has been jumped on. If you remember in 2015, his family was essentially jumped while they were having dinner at a pub by a bunch of protesters dressed up as breastfeeding mothers and migrants. That was quite shocking at the time. 2 years before that, he had to be rescued by the police after pro-Scottish independence and anti-racist protesters shouted, "Nigel, you're a ball bag." So, you know, pretty infantile at the same level. Jacob Rees-Mogg last year, essentially a brawl broke out and he was called Nazi and scum and all these things. The fact is, yeah, as Tom says, this is infantile. And I think it's a debasement of politics where you resort to using words like Nazi, which are very historically specific. It's very crass to call, for example, Kay Burley a slag, as some people have done, stood outside Parliament. All of that is just stupid. But what's more stupid or more dangerous is the reaction to it. There's also a worrying thing growing in that MPs seem to believe that they are supposed to be protected from the public, forgetting that they are actual public servants. It reminds me of the time that when I was at Sussex University a number of years ago, David Willetts, who was then the education minister, took a student to court for calling him a coward. I mean, there's been a long history of MPs thinking that they are above public scrutiny. Are we saying that we are living in a free society where we can criticise our politicians or not? Or are they royalty and we can't touch?
I think that's right. I think there is now an expectation of deference from some MPs, you know, especially in relation to online, where people see the slightest hint of insult as abusive. So for instance, you know, there was a Tory MP, Antoinette Sandbach, who actually phoned the police on a constituent because they had a disagreement over Brexit. So there seems to be a lot of MPs who are very thin-skinned and simply cannot take an insult, and b, a lot of them who I think expect to be treated as royalty. They expect deference rather than to be engaged with politically.
I know, and just on the question of double standards and the word Nazi, I mean, if we're actually going to go around setting the precedent, which hurling the word Nazi at someone you disagree with is a criminal offence, then there's going to be barely anyone on the left after it. I mean, that's become the go-to insult for anyone who just so happens to be to the right of centre for quite a long time in this country. But I think it's worth noting, of course, that one of the protesters involved in this kind of weird, very small Gilets Jaunes tribute act, which has been going on outside of Parliament, is this guy called James Goddard. There's been a fair bit of reporting on him. He is, by all accounts, seemingly a xenophobic scumbag. Came up through various kind of campaigns, one out of West London, this kind of Justice for Our Boys campaign, which is basically putting about this conspiracy theory that a hit and run was actually some sort of terrorist attack that was covered up. This is not to say that these individuals are just ordinary people expressing their views representative of the thwarted Brexit masses. That's clearly not the case. They do have their own agenda. They are also quite illiberal. I actually found his Gab profile, which is that kind of free speech alternative to Twitter. The first thing in his profile says free speech, but then he uses quite liberal use of the hashtag ban Islam. So tells you something about their commitment to freedom. But nevertheless, and this is a point that particularly the left forget time and time again, is that in defending these people's right to protest, you're not defending the content of their views. You're just saying that, again, as long as people don't cross the line into violence and threats, that they have a right to be there. They have a right to make their voices heard, and that it's incredibly dangerous not to defend those rights, because the lesson of history is that, again, if you create a precedent whereby protest can be clamped down upon, it will reach you. I mean, the conversation this week has been about the Public Order Act 1986, which our columnist Luke Gittos wrote about this week. People saying that this needed to be enforced properly and needed to be enforced across the board. A lot of people on the left making this argument. First of all, the fact that Public Order Act 1986 was an explicitly anti-left-wing piece of legislation. It was brought in by the Thatcher administration in the wake of the Brixton riots and the miners' strike. And also, the history of public order legislation in this country has been an agitation for them in the response to kind of far-right threats, you know, the British Union of Fascists back in the 30s, etc. But then being used time and time again against the left as well. And a lot of people who were agitating for them suddenly wondering why that had happened. It's because you have to defend these things on the basis of principle, and it doesn't matter who the people are exercising those rights, whether it's a James Goddard or anyone else. You set a very dangerous precedent if you go around basically trying to call the police in to deal with these people.
And one kind of question that it raises or has been posed a lot by this is what's the difference between harassment and genuine protest? And it seems to me, looking at a lot of the commentary from particularly people like Owen Jones, people on the left, it's harassment when I don't like the people and I disagree with their message. And it's legitimate protest if they're my friends and I agree with what they're saying. Because, you know, as we might all recall, John McDonnell saying a number of years ago during the coalition government that Tory ministers and Lib Dem ministers shouldn't be allowed to show their face in public without being hounded. And you know what? I think that's fair enough. I think if you disagree with an MP, you have absolutely every right to protest them. But the fact is that many on the left can't see a continuity between those things. They simply say, well, one is protest, one is harassment. And clearly, it is entirely subjective, the difference between the two. And we cannot allow the authorities to decide which is which.
Just to bring it back to Anna Soubry, I mean, she, during a television interview, hugged the guy, I don't know his name, who stands in a top hat shouting, "Stop Brexit," through every single interview.
Steve, is it?
Steve, oh, yeah. And has been doing for months. He's ruined some of my interviews. But she hugged him and said, "Oh, I know Steve, he's great." So, you know, Steve wasn't calling her a Nazi or a slag or any of the kind of stupid stuff that the other people were shouting. But he was being harassing, annoyance. He was protesting, fair enough. You have to remember that Anna Soubry has positioned herself as one of the top anti-Brexit politicians. So fair enough that people are really angry at her.
Well, the other thing that's worth noting is that this whole discussion about the harassing of politicians, and as Ella was just saying, in relation to Brexit, happens at the same week in which there's been two pretty huge votes in Parliament whereby Parliament are effectively trying to wrest back control of the Brexit process from the executive, allegedly to try and stop the excesses of executive overreach. But we all know why they're doing it, to try and stop Brexit happening entirely at the moment, to try and take no deal off the table. And I just think, to tackle what Ella's saying, I think it's absolutely remarkable that you have politicians who are actively going against the wishes, in some cases, of their actual own constituents. You know, Anna Soubry represents Broxtow, voted relatively heavily to leave. People seem to forget this. And the idea that they should expect no blowback, the idea that as soon as someone heckles them on the street, this should be, you know, the forces of the arm wing of the state should be rallied to protect them from it, I think just shows that it's almost like they're either refusing to recognise what it is they're doing, or they're just bluffing their way through this. I think it's absolutely remarkable that there's been as little protest as there has been.
Really hope you're enjoying the show so far. I'd just like to take a really quick moment to say a massive thank you to everyone who has been donating to Spiked. I know loads of you who listen have either donated in the past or make regular monthly donations, and it's honestly thanks to your contributions and your generosity that we can keep going and growing. Spiked has some really exciting plans for the year ahead with our podcast, and we need the help of listeners and readers like you. It's your donations that will allow us to make that happen. So if you haven't before, do please consider making a donation, or even better, setting up a monthly donation. It's really easy to do, I promise. Just go to spiked-online.com and click the red donate button in the top right corner. Thank you so much. And now back to the show. Newly elected Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is rarely out of the spotlight. Last week, she was at the centre of a confected Twitter storm over a video of her dancing back in college. So what's behind all the fuss about AOC?
What the last couple of weeks have shown is that it's on the one hand a large level of enthusiasm about her, obviously from certain sections of the left in America, but also this tendency for her to become this kind of all-purpose kind of culture war target, I guess. I mean, this whole discussion about Ocasio-Cortez has really been exploded in the last couple of weeks around this video that this kind of online right-wing troll dug up of her during her college years at Boston University doing this dance routine, putting it up there saying that this was the nitwit that everyone in the Democratic Party is very excited about, and then there being this huge backlash amongst Ocasio-Cortez and her supporters. She even putting out a video of her kind of dancing a little bit outside of her congressional office saying that I hear the GOP don't like women dancing, so here you go. Now, it's important to note that this in particular was an entirely confected scandal. You know, it was a handful of anonymous accounts who were tweeting about this despairingly. Those accounts have since been deleted. And I haven't seen a single Republican of any stature, certainly, say anything to the effect of they think it's scandalous that women are dancing. But nevertheless, I think it does show one thing about the Ocasio-Cortez phenomenon, which Brendan O'Neill wrote about this week, which is she is, to a large extent, become a kind of social media phenomenon. Mm. She's someone who's very popular on Twitter, very popular on social media, and seems to have become the centre for a lot of these, in some cases, quite confected battles. And he makes the point that in many respects, she's the first Twitter politician, a kind of meme made flesh. And I think after the past week, you could easily say that that is the case.
Yeah, a nice little fact. She has more Twitter followers than all of her fellow newly elected Democratic congresswomen combined. She has more Twitter followers than Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who's been involved in politics for decades. And I think it's absolutely true to say that, you know, her whole shtick revolves around the internet. You know, she is constantly posting Instagram updates. People get really excited about every tweet and every post and are hanging on her every word, seemingly. And yet you have to remind yourself, she was only sworn in last week. You know, and yet she's this superstar, all things to all people.
Yeah.
She's the great hope of the socialist left for some. And then she's a dangerous Marxist to, you know, the folks at Fox News. And it is completely a phantasm. It is a complete projection of basically whatever people are thinking at the moment. You can just project it onto this, you know, young woman.
Yeah, it's very weird, the situation of so-called AOC, because on the one hand, yeah, she is this radical new hope. She's seen as very controversial, revolutionary. People talk about her being the queen from Queens. Mm. And then Vogue, you know, can you imagine a more establishment, posh, rich magazine, Vogue, ran an article saying that she might just be the future of the Democratic Party. Mm. I mean, she's also being quite quickly subsumed into that. The Democrat Party said she isn't going to be even, I think, a Bernie Sanders type figure. No. There's no promise of her being anything like that. Mm. She's just a young woman who's a bit fiery, quite charismatic, and certainly knows how to work social media. Only last night, it came out that the Daily Caller, right-wing publication, published a story with their headline saying, "Is this a nude selfie of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?"
Oh,
it was a picture from Reddit of someone's feet in a bath, which wasn't her feet. And, you know, completely ridiculous. You could even push it to say, you know, trying to be insulting, you know, publishing a headline saying, is this a nude picture of a politician? But instead of just brushing it off, instead of just saying, what a load of rubbish, again, she comes out and says, this is what happens when women run for office. You know, this is what happens when women get involved in politics, using the kind of right wing salacious obsession with her as a means to bolster herself, as a means to push her popularity by saying, look, I am the female hope for all this horrible mess of misogyny. I mean, like you said, she's only just come into her position. We're yet to see what she does. But I can't see this social media phenomenon translating into real life consequences. I mean, there's no reason why just because she has 2.2 million Twitter followers, she's going to be a good politician.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what's interesting, her words were, I'm being overly scrutinized in relation to this nude photo. And I think, yes, that's true. She is being overly scrutinized because, you know,
she's also being overly celebrated. Exactly, and that seems to me to be the crux of it. Because aside from the kind of, you know, the right wing idiocy that presents anyone who's slightly to the left of Nancy Pelosi in America, or just Nancy Pelosi, you know,
she's a socialist.
She's some sort of, you know, California crypto Marxist, according to some people. But nevertheless, I think you do also have to look at the claims that she's making about herself and the claims that her supporters are making about her, because it really is blowing her radicalness and her importance way out of proportion. First of all, her claim was that she represented this new, diverse, working class movement in America when she won this huge upset in the Democratic primary in June in the 14th Congressional District of New York. So she beat Joe Crowley, who was really part of the Democratic machine there, was very close to Nancy Pelosi, had been around for a very long time. But as Politico pointed out, if you actually went precinct by precinct, the places that voted very heavily for Ocasio-Cortez were the whiter, more affluent, more gentrified parts of the district, and the places that voted very overwhelmingly for Crowley turned out to be the Hispanic and African-American working class communities. And that one funny thing about that campaign was she was what made gentrification a big plank of her campaigning, and yet it really was the gentrifiers who backed her in the end. And then on this claim that she is some socialist, she calls herself a democratic socialist. It's not entirely clear what that means. I mean, I saw one interview with her on the progressive podcast Pod Save America, and the host quite reasonably said, look, I believe in single-payer healthcare, one of her main pledges. I believe that college should be free, but I still consider myself, and I think he's accurate in describing himself as such, a liberal Democrat who believes in regulated capitalism.
Yeah.
So how are you different to me? And she really couldn't answer the question. She ended up saying something to the effect of, it just means something that's a little bit more radical than your average Democrat. You know, she's one of these people who genuinely says effectively that her policies are really about bringing the Democrats more in line with like the Labour Party in the United Kingdom or Sweden, etc. This is not a socialist programme, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. But on the one hand, it's ridiculous to suggest that she represents real radical change. She's, you know, there's not a hell of a lot of difference between her and someone like Nancy Pelosi. As a lot of people have said, this is a difference in style more than anything else, and I think that's pretty correct. But then again, that makes it all the more ridiculous that you've got these right-wing pundits saying she wants to put them on a fast track to Venezuela. You know, it kind of speaks to the childishness of the debate, the kind of strange mixing of political categories in this discussion, that she's taken this seriously, either by, you know, the left or the right in that respect.
And what's interesting actually about the style, she's very much in the mold of modern identity politics. It's the college campus style. And so it's actually completely unsurprising, as you said, it's the wealthier parts of New York that supported her. It's also unsurprising that the Democratic Socialists of America are talked up as this great phenomenon of this new hope for the Democratic Party, but are struggling to win support beyond those kind of hipster, gentrified neighbourhoods. Lots of people clearly are having a lot of fun playing at being socialists, while actually being kind of ignored by normal working people.
I think this is definitely where social media plays an important role, because you don't have to win over workers or mass working class voters if you're able to pose as something on social media. One of the things that was really interesting within that Vogue article celebrating Cortez as the kind of new radical hope was a video of her visiting a child migrant centre with about 15 to 20, maybe more, reporters, people filming, taking pictures around her. It was her and one other woman shouting at a guard there, saying free the children, the border guard taking no notice. I mean, it was just such a stunt. Mm. It was ridiculous. It was embarrassing, actually. Not only because they were all dressed in white for some reason. It was a very weird video.
But she's an angel.
Yeah, but and the message was really clear. Look how much I care. I go with my entourage to the border to a fence in the dust and the heat, and I shout at border guards, you know, but I don't know what she would do to actually make some difference. What, talk to Mexican voters, talk to Latina voters, get that kind of support, actually launch some kind of a campaign against it. I mean, she may well do in the future, but it shows that this is sort of where I think the Democrat Party is, both parties, but certainly the Democrats are failing in challenging Trump, is that they keep pinning their hopes on these sort of social media stars who are just going to, like a match, kind of burn out within, what, a year maybe? How long can this popularity last?
And I think just on Fraser's point about identity politics, if anything, she's this kind of character who's this weird fusion of like supposedly socialist politics and identity politics, insofar as almost socialism becoming a kind of identity.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to have a lot of intellectual rigour to it. It doesn't even necessarily have to apply to socialist policies as we might generally understand them. But for instance, she did 60 Minutes in the past week, and she was pulled up on the fact that she's been fact-checked a few times by the Washington Post, by PolitiFact, etc. I think she put out a tweet in which she suggested that the Pentagon could have paid for Medicare for All, and apparently that wasn't strictly correct. Now, that kind of nitpicking fact-checking can be quite irritating, and she made the point, which is a fair point to make, that some people are more focused on being exactly right rather than morally right. But nevertheless, I think that did underscore something quite important, which is, unfortunately, socialism has for a long time, both in the UK and America, to the extent which it was talked about there, just become to mean being a good person.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that, though I think Ocasio-Cortez deserves a bit of credit for what she said previously, which is to say you can't just wail at Trump, you have to look at the reasons people voted for him, etc. Nevertheless, I think one thing that does put people off is it is that kind of sense of moral righteousness, that sense of virtue signalling, that transformation of what previously might have been an economic programme into just a kind of image, really, which I think is, A, not really going to win a lot of people over, but actually will probably put a lot of people off as well.
Hi there, I really hope you're enjoying the show so far. And if you are, why not help us spread the word? One really, really simple way of doing that is by giving us a rating and a review with your podcast provider. It won't take you very long, but honestly, it will make a massive, massive difference for us. So we'd be hugely grateful if you could just take a tiny bit of time to give us a rating and a review. Right, back to the show. Breaking Bad star Bryan Cranston has defended his decision to play a quadriplegic billionaire in the comedy drama The Upside. He said, which might seem obvious to some, that as actors, we're asked to be other people to play other people. So what's behind this kind of controversy? I mean, this isn't the first time actors have been pulled up for representing something that they're not.
You know, there's a real fascination now with the idea of authenticity, that you have to actually be a disabled person to play a disabled figure in a fictional tale, or you have to be gay to play a gay person, all this kind of stuff. So Bryan Cranston now is just the latest person to feel the ire of identitarians, as they're called, using the word problematic. You know, Bryan Cranston is that horrible word, problematic. And fair play to him, because he's just come out and said, I'm an actor.
Yeah.
Anyone who's got any interest in the arts knows that the whole skill and the art of being an actor is to pretend like you're someone else and pretend so convincingly that it is genuinely authentic, because then you know the audience believes you. I mean, I'm pretty sure in saying that he didn't become a drug addict or a drug cartel, you know, runner when he was playing Breaking Bad. Maybe he wasn't even a dad when he was in Malcolm in the Middle. I mean, you know, it's a kind of ridiculous situation, but this has happened time and time again. But it's refreshing for someone to actually come out and defend the art and the skill of acting, which means pretending to be someone that you're not.
Exactly. And obviously this comes in the context of not just questions about disabled actors playing disabled roles, but obviously a lot of questions about LGBT representation and a lot of really quite increasingly kind of ludicrous scandals. You know, you had the discussion a couple of months back about whether or not Jack Whitehall should play Disney's allegedly first openly gay character in a film, which, as I remember it, was about which was based on a theme park ride. So not exactly Oscar winning material, but there was this discussion about how he shouldn't have been given that role. Around the same time, you had the actress Ruby Rose, who was used to play Catwoman in a TV series, despite the fact that she is gay and Catwoman is also gay, that she wasn't gay enough, apparently. So there is a kind of ridiculous level to this, and it does resurrect typecasting, actually, in that respect. And this is something that actually Ben Whishaw talked about this week in interviews around the Golden Globes, where he was asked about the actor Darren Criss, who played Gianni Versace's gay assassin in that FX series, who quite, you know, came out with this wonderful statement that he was no longer going to play gay characters. And Whishaw actually said, hold on a second, I think the best situation we could be in is that more gay actors can play straight roles and vice versa. But nevertheless, I think it's important to note that there is a bit more nuance to the question of kind of disabled actors. There's a disabled actor and campaigner called Adam Pearson, who I've debated on TV about this, who is very nice bloke, very sound on a lot of these issues. And the point he makes is just that a lot of the time, in terms of disabled actors, it's difficult for them to get in the room. It's difficult for them to get an audition. They're not necessarily seen as bankable in the same way that a Bryan Cranston might be. And he points out that despite the fact there's various kind of very Oscar worthy performances which have won at the Academy over the years, if you think about My Left Foot or things like this, there's very, very few disabled actors who have actually been given those kinds of roles and those kinds of accolades. Nevertheless, I think even he has conceded that this doesn't mean that you have to go around casting someone whose exact experience mirrors that of their character, because at the end of the day, that is called acting, frankly.
I think one of the things that it represents for me is the way that you know, we now see culture as the means through which we correct society's problems. So if, you know, for instance, we see black people or LGBT people as disadvantaged, the route to changing that is to have better representation on the silver screen. And, you know, that's kind of a problem, really, for me, because it means that we're not dealing with issues at the political level. We're bypassing the politics almost, and we're treating audiences as kind of thickos who need to have the right messages drummed into them in order to make them more progressive, essentially. You know, and what's interesting is that actually casting decisions should be an artistic one.
Oh, definitely.
And we rarely talk about them on an artistic level. It's talked about purely on the level of representation, purely on the level of identity. And, you know, the art is element of it is sidelined.
You can see that in the case of how many films there are with actors with bad accents. I mean, I am appalled at the number of Irish films that employ British or American people to do dreadful Irish accents. Why can't they just find authentic Irish actors? No, but what the serious point I'm making is that this isn't about, if it was just about, as Tom says, getting work for disabled actors, giving more opportunities to people, I don't see any reasonable person having a problem with that. Mm-hmm. But actually what this is about is saying that it's damaging, it's problematic, it's offensive to have non-disabled people play disabled roles, or as we've seen in some other cases, light-skinned black people playing dark-skinned roles, or straight people playing gay roles. You know, it gets very ugly very quickly. And that is really about making a judgment on the audience and what the audience needs, you know, the political message that the audience needs to be fed, rather than talking about artistic freedom.
And it also kind of just, again, is incredibly philistine in relation to casting, in relation to characterization. I mean, it almost suggests that if you have a gay character or a disabled character, whatever, that they're defined by their identity in that film, whether it's a person from reality in a kind of biopic, or whether it's a fictional character. The idea that they can just be boiled down to their sexual preference or how able-bodied they are. Human beings are incredibly complicated, and actors, for all different various reasons, are better placed or less better placed to inhabit that character based on their own skills, different life experiences they draw on, etc. It's incredibly philistine to suggest that just because you happen to have the same sexual preferences as a character you might be able to portray, that you can inhabit that person any better than anyone else. You know, I think it speaks to the increasingly philistine times we live in, that this debate seems to kind of rage on and on and on. And it does just kind of put, again, a bit of a increasing kind of pressure on artistic freedom, on directors, on casting directors, etc., of making decisions that they want to make. And whilst, again, we can talk about access, we can talk about opportunity, again, it does come down to the fact that people are making these decisions for a whole range of reasons. And if you try and just subject it to a kind of more political agenda, you're only really going to bastardize the format in that respect.
You've been listening to the Spike podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, don't forget to give us a rating, a review, or even make a donation. We'll be back next week, but for more Spike content every day, visit spiked-online.com.